Tonight, a very special look at remote viewing through the eyes and the mind of Paul Smith, author of the book Reading the Enemy's Mind, a compelling story about what we did with the Stargate program. We'll be back with Paul Smith in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Paul Smith has a BA degree from Brigham Young University, an MS from the Defense Intelligence College, and a graduate student in the PhD program in philosophy at the University of Texas, Austin. He enlisted in the Army in 1976, served for 7 years in the government's remote viewing psychic espionage program at Fort Meade, Maryland. He is one of only a handful of government personnel to be personally trained in coordinate remote viewing, called CVR. By Ingo Swan at the SRI International, one of the best. He was the primary author of the government's RV program and CRV's training manual and served as theory instructor for the new CRV training personnel. I was proud enough to be able to get an advanced copy of Paul's book some time ago called Reading the Enemy's Mind, where I offered some quotes about that, and Paul was gracious enough to put it in his book. Well worth reading if you love remote viewing or you want to know what really is on the enemy's mind. Paul Smith on Coast to Coast. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Hi, George. Hey, it's great to hear you again.
And likewise, nice to have you back too, especially nowadays where there seems to be so much interest in international affairs, more so, Paul, than I've ever seen in my life. I'm going to tell you an interesting story. When I was working in my early television days in Detroit, and we would kick around what kind of stories we put in our local news and things like that, and I used to produce the 11 o'clock newscast, which was the big newscast for our local television station, and all of us at that time, and we were pretty young then, we were in our 20s, all we really wanted to concentrate on was local news, you know, whatever it might be, whether it's the fire, the murder, or the events that happened locally in Detroit. That's what we wanted to cover. Very rarely did we start looking at national news or international news. You know, every once in a while, when there was a spectacular story, we'd run maybe 30 seconds. And then when Watergate started to occur, we got more and more interested in that. Now it seems that international news and national news is just as important, if not more so, than local news. And I've got to believe the field you were in, that of remote viewing, probably would be better off to be used today than even then when you were doing it.
Well, I think it certainly could have a lot of value, value that isn't, of course, being realized to its fullest right now. You know, it's interesting. I was just thinking somewhat along the lines of what you were just saying just a couple of days ago. I was thinking, well, you know, we've got such a global focus now. Even people who, you know, four decades ago would have been just out on the farm, they might know what Aunt Sally was doing, you know, the next Sunday. Now they know what's going on in Bangladesh or, you know, the People's Republic of China or somewhere else. And it just seemed kind of odd. But then I thought about it. Today, more than ever before in the history of the world, somebody on the other side of the globe can reach out and touch what has become essentially that person's neighbor and completely on the other side of the planet from him or her in ways that we could never have imagined 40 years ago.
And it can be done instantly.
That's right.
Paul, I want to talk and spend some time this hour about the government and what it did with the program with you and others, and then get into some of the other things we're going to talk about tonight. Okay. And then, of course, last hour, we're keeping you for phone calls. Tell us a little bit about the Stargate program and your involvement, how they found you.
Just a quick introduction. The program itself got started really in 1972 in the science lab, SRI International, which used to be Stanford Research Institute, part of Stanford University. It was the CIA was looking for somebody to answer the question, why are the Soviets spending millions of dollars in parapsychology research that made no sense? And, Ingo Swan, who you also mentioned, and Dr. Harold Puthoff, a physicist who happened to be at SRI, got together in a kind of fortuitous way and program started from there. The CIA contracted with them to research this, among other people, including Russell Targ and others. Ultimately, the military got involved, and for altogether 23 years, the program pursued, this strange mental ability that we refer now to as remote viewing, as a means to support national defense. I got into it completely accidentally. Well, at least on my part. I had no idea this stuff even existed. It was, I never entertained the idea that government could be involved in this. And just, I happened to be in a Mideast, actually a Mideast analyst position at Fort Meade, and a couple of my friends in the neighborhood, whom I didn't have any idea what they were involved in, a couple of them came to me and said, you know, we've been watching you. Which was strange in itself.
Exactly. That's kind of jarring when someone comes up and tells you that.
That's right.
We've been watching you.
And they said, we think you might be good in the black program we're working in. And I said, okay. I was always up for an adventure, so I said, okay, tell me more. They said, well, we'd like you to take some tests. So I took the tests, and they ended up recruiting me into this program in a very kind of Men in Black episode. I ended up being a remote viewer, it was something that, you know, a month before I had no idea even existed.
Did you have to take the test first then before they told you what the program was?
Yes, that was one of the conditions. They were looking go ahead.
Had you not qualified, I bet they wouldn't even have told you.
They would have said, well, you know, we appreciate your time, but thanks, but no thanks.
Exactly. And you'd say, well, what was the program? And they'd say, we can't tell you.
It's well, not only that, but my ego would have been destroyed for the rest of my life, so it's a good thing that I guess that I did what I did, whatever. So, yeah.
How did they know to approach you, though? I mean, what did you show them? What did they see for them to come up to you and say, you know what? He might be worth giving this remote viewing test to. Let's check him out.
They were looking for Army intelligence officers who were competent in their field and seemed to be reasonably intelligent and all that, plus interested in things that weren't necessarily normal, so to speak, for an Army intelligence officer. You know, some kind of creative endeavor, art, like painting and drawing, music, languages, or, you know, creative writing and things like that. Well, they discovered I had majored in art in college. I had trained in or was fluent in three different languages. I played guitar, and I wrote short stories. And so they figured, well, this guy's probably worth looking at, you know. So
they weren't out there looking for trained remote viewers, because not a lot of people even knew, like you said, what that meant. They were looking for people that they merely thought that could work, and they wanted to test them.
They, in fact, were looking for people who didn't claim to be psychic in the first place. They, in fact, didn't want people who thought they were psychic, because those folks tend to have a lot to unlearn, the way that we were going to be taught how to do it. So, in fact, it was good that I didn't know much about this, didn't care about it, and, in fact, kind of disbelieved in it a little bit. I was mildly skeptical about the existence of any kind of ESP.
Paul, tell us about the test they gave you.
Well, the tests were mostly psychological and personality-type tests. In fact, many of your listeners have probably taken some of these. One was the, you know, an extended form of the Myers-Briggs-type inventory. There was a Minnesota multiphasic inventory, and there was a couple of specialized ones to evaluate, your feelings and beliefs about different kinds of things. And,
well, explain those first two tests that you just mentioned.
Well, the Myers-Briggs assigns four letters as a kind of a pigeonhole you personality-wise, what type of personality you have. And there's this 16 possible different types of personality you could get, and it's analyzed in terms of whether you're introverted, extroverted, whether you're intuitive or sensing. In other words, do you form conclusions, or do you base it on seeing as believing, emotional versus thinking, perceiving versus judging, and they have specialized terms what that means. But you end up with a profile of four letters. I, for example, was an ENTP, which meant I was extroverted, intuitive, thinking, and perceptive. So that was pretty interesting. You know, a lot of businesses use that, because even though everyone is different, you can get these broad generalizations about how they might, how people might behave in interacting with other people, and how they approach the world. And that's what this was useful for. They were able to tell whether I might be flexible in approaching this new thing, and if I'd be open to inputs that I wasn't usually accustomed to getting, things like that.
Okay, so you take the test. What percent are they looking for success here?
Well, I don't know. That's hard to say. I mean, the personality types they were looking for represent altogether about 10% of the population. It turns out that their net was too narrow. There were a number of personality types who could just walk right in and do this, and virtually anyone was able to do it to some degree. So, you know, sure, there are some personality types that might learn it more easily or deal with it more easily, but in general, if you train people right, anybody can do it, is what it ultimately amounted to.
Were you going in there, Paul, to get trained as well?
Yes. Which, you know, of course, in the early evaluation stage, didn't know. But they were actually looking for people to put through this new training program that had been developed out at SRI. And, in fact, Ingo Swan was one of the primary movers in that. It was a methodology that Ingo credits Hal Puthoff with a great deal of input in. So I call it the Swan-Puthoff method, which, you know, came to be known as CRV, coordinate remote viewing. Now it's called controlled remote viewing, but it's the same thing. And they had a contract. This is interesting. They had a government-let contract for training, but they hadn't yet identified anybody to be trained. So that was kind of funny. So they were out beating the bushes for people they thought might be good, and they already had one. I was the second one, and they soon identified a third one. And that was the base of the contract. And then someone who was outside the unit, who you've had on your show, and Art Bell's had on a lot, Ed Dames, was brought along later on, and he joined us, although he was not part of the unit at the time. He belonged to a different unit, which thought it might want to develop its own little remote viewing capability.
Ed is remote viewed, by the way, to the Ukraine, where I think he's going to get married. He has sent us a picture of his new wife-to-be, and he's very happy.
Yes, I actually saw that picture. You know, the one thing about Ed Dames is he's always doing something that surprises us.
he was the rebel of the group, huh?
Yeah, he was. He kind of lived on the edge of things. And in one way, that kept us from getting stuck in the mud, but it also was challenging at times. So
with this group that has been assembled at this time, who heads it up? Was it Ingo? Was it Puthoff? Who was in charge?
Well, as with any government program, that's a bit complicated. We were in the Army program, which actually didn't have any direct official connection except through contract with SRI. So Ingo was, in a sense, a contractor, and Hal as well. The military program immediately was, our unit was commanded by a lieutenant colonel named Brian Busby at that time, and up the chain, you went up through the normal organizational chain to General Bert Stubblebine, who was the commander of the Army Intelligence Security Command, and Stubblebine had a direct interest in what we were doing, although he was pretty hands-off. He didn't come down and micromanage or anything, but he did pay attention to what we were doing and keep track of it through briefings and things like that.
Were you told, Paul, don't say anything about what you folks are doing?
Oh, yes. It was, I mentioned a Men in Black episode a little while ago. It was a lot like that, where we basically, I wasn't, under many circumstances, supposed to let anybody know I was even in the Army when I was off base, you know, out traveling around or anything like that. And so there were lots of things we couldn't talk about, especially the program. It was what we call a SAP, a special access program. We weren't, there was only perhaps 150 people in the entire country who knew about the existence of that program, who'd been officially read onto it anyway.
Who would interact with you and the group? Would it be some high-level military people? How did you get the information back and forth?
There was a dedicated I guess you'd call it a stovepipe, that would bring taskings in through, you know, different agencies would want to task us, and they would come to, certain operations officers that we had that were really outside the unit. They were at either at INSCOM level or they were at the deputy chief of staff for intelligence level, although they didn't call it back then, that would get them passed to either our operations officer or our boss, the lieutenant colonel. Our operations officer was, now he goes by Skip Atwater. At that time, he was Fred.
Sure.
and Fred actually, Fred was the one that formed the unit in the first place in a very interesting way. Usually you don't find a lieutenant creating a unit like that, but he happened to be the right guy at the right place when he was a lieutenant, was directed to form the unit, and you know, of course with other people involved, did do so and stayed on as the operations and training officer for 10 years. Developed a great deal of expertise, and lots of legends have formed around things that Skip Atwater did with, of course, the viewers that he was working with.
Were you going to be a lifer in the Army? How long did you plan to stay in?
Well, by the time I'd become an officer, I'd pretty well decided to make it a career. I'd started off as an enlisted man.
Yeah.
Wanted to be an Arabic linguist, and somehow I progressed up through the ranks quicker than I had expected to. The Army kept, you know, I kept thinking, well, maybe I ought to get out, and then the Army would give me one more, yet more interesting thing to do than I'd done before. And, you know, it's really hard to quit when they keep making your life more and more interesting and more fun. And, you know, this remote viewing thing was, I would say, almost the crown of the whole thing. And in many respects, it was. And so by the time I got the boring jobs I'd been in so long, there was no point in getting out. So,
did you enjoy working with the people you worked with?
For the most part, yes. With any office where, you know, you're interacting closely, there's personality quirks that, you know, that cause trouble and, you know, people don't get along and stuff. But for the most part, we did get along very well. And I'm still friends with many of those folks that we were in the office with, you know, the viewers and the others, some of whom nobody knows who they are even to this day.
Who trained you, Paul? Was it Ingo Swann and Puthoff, or... I mean, how did that all transpire once you got in there?
Yeah, it was Ingo Swann. You know, Puthoff had a role. That was the first part of it. We learned up through, you know, the kind of remote viewing we do is called, it has six stages. And Ingo trained us through the basic, you know, material all the way up through stage three, which is really the core of what you're doing. And then because of the various politics, the Army was told to get rid of the remote viewing program, and so contracts that they were working on were canceled. We had no further training from outside. Fortunately, Atwater had kind of anticipated this might happen. He'd gotten a lot of the training material. He'd learned a lot about the process. And we also had another viewer who was kind of the pilot remote viewer that had been trained by Ingo, and he had been trained all the way through. And so the two of them working together then brought the three of us that belonged to the unit the rest of the way up to speed on the remaining three stages, and we became operational from that point.
Did you leave the military also at that point?
Oh, no. We pretended to have left the military. We wore civilian clothes, got to wear our hair long. One of us even wore a beard, you know, so we pretended to be civilians for the next, well, several years. But, you know, as the wheels of the Army grind, eventually I got pulled back to reality, as they'd look on it, and got sent off to Desert Storm, and then I had to wear a uniform again. So,
even though the program got canceled, did you come away with it, even with your own ability, saying remote viewing works?
Oh, yes. There was no question in my mind about that. I mean, once you've seen this done enough times and you've done it yourself enough times where you do indeed accurately describe a target to which you have no connection other than your own mental faculties, you know, it seems almost silly to even think that it doesn't work. When I hear people question it, I there's always in the back of my mind something, well, you just don't understand.
Paul's incredible work is called Reading the Enemy's Mind. You can find it, of course, on Amazon.com. Is it still in the bookstores, Paul?
It is in some. I think Barnes & Noble usually have a copy or two around. Of course, with any book, after about a year, it kind of disappears, unless it's something like The Scarlet Letter or something's been around.
And then there's a coast-to-coast appearance, and the publishers go, what the heck's going on?
Yeah, I hope they're surprised this time around. We'll see.
Let's talk about your websites when we come back, and also your mission when you were in this program. We'll be back. And our special guest tonight, Paul Smith, as we talk about reading the enemy's mind inside Stargate remote viewing. Back with Paul in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Paul, what was the mission then for the Stargate group? What were you channeled to do?
Well, that's an interesting choice of words. We were kind of served at the behest of the intelligence community. Any customer that came in with a tasking that seemed to be something we could do, they would, we would work it, and that could be anything from finding hostages or attempting to find hostages, to describing the inside of a Soviet chemical warfare plant, to missiles, Iranian missiles, and the Sokor missiles, the Persian Gulf. It was a broad range. It was all, of course, defense related. A lot of it was operational. We did a lot of experimental kinds of things. Of course, they didn't differentiate for us. They didn't want us to know when we were working an operational target, when we were working a research target. And often we didn't even know when we were working training targets. They didn't want our conscious minds to get in the way. So it was all military-related, but a wide variety of things.
Were they serious in their requests for targets?
The customers, you mean?
Yes. Interesting, too, you call them customers.
Well, you tend to do that. In any intelligence discipline, you call the people who... Well, it depends. Sometimes you call them customers. Sometimes you call them consumers. It all amounts to the same thing.
Well, so. Clients? You ever say that? Clients?
Not usually.
Okay.
Because, these are also military folks, most of them.
Right.
So, we all pretty much work the same thing. I mean, you get transferred, you could end up being on the other end of that process and be, tasking the people who just... been tasking you, things like
sure.
that.
So when the customer came in then, were they darn serious about what they wanted done, or were they a little hesitant, or did they think, what a man, somebody sent me in here?
Well, usually they, some of them were just seeing what we might turn out. Others were convinced that we provide them a good product, and others, we usually didn't get the ones who were skeptical about it. They might be tentative, they may be unsure, but they would at least give us a try. So they'd give us a tasking. And, of course, we viewers never interact with the customers, although at other times later on I did kind of get the feel for what kind of folks these were and what kind of tasking they were giving us and that sort of thing. So,
no,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
You were with the program 7 years. Is that the length of the program in total?
No. The actual military part of it, was roughly 18 years. At a grand total of 23, there was kind of a parallel military effort during 18 of those years. And so I was there for 7 of those years. Other people there for varying lengths of time, from ranging just from about a year all the way up to, I think the longest was probably 10 years. I think it was probably the longest anybody actually served in the unit.
What seemed to be, Paul, their biggest concern? Did you notice with the customers now, any immediate concern on their part when they'd come in?
Well, again, we didn't interact with them very much, but the kind of taskings changed with the climate in the world. What are the Defense Department and the nation's main security concerns? When we first started doing operational taskings, those of us who'd been trained, there comes a point when you stop doing the training and you start doing the real-world things. Our main focus at that point was Soviet research and development kinds of targets, weapons programs the Soviets might be involved in. For example, directed energy weapons, and that they were just now developing and that they... we wanted to know about, the defense establishment wanted to know about, and they didn't have any other means of doing that, so they would target us on that in those situations where they didn't have any other means. But later on, we had a very large focus on the hostage situation in Lebanon, where there were a number of Westerners, and many of them Americans, who were being held hostage out in the hinterlands or in Beirut or who knows where, and they used this to do that. And then later on, that changed again to counter-narcotics when the hostage situation was resolved. And then as the Cold War was kind of winding down, we became worried about the war on drugs. And so somebody approached the unit, and we were tasked to do counter-narcotics type missions. So, it changed over time.
Were you told when you were successful or not as a group?
Sometimes, but rarely. There was this thinking that who knows when we're actually done with a particular project. There's always possible we might have to go back and revisit that project as viewers. And the one thing you want viewers to be doing is operating blindly. You don't want them to know what the target is. We were kept as blind as possible for the most part. There were exceptions to that. I won't go into all of that. It's too complicated. But generally, the best way to handle a remote viewer is to keep that person blind to the target, because if they're witting, if they are aware of what the target is, then everything they could guess about it, everything they infer, every memory, thing they'd heard about it, whatever, is right there in their conscious mind. And then it's almost impossible to unravel what's the actual signal from what's all of this pre-existing stuff that may or may not be true.
I'm sure you guys got together as a group and kicked around, what's going on out there in the real world? Why do they want to know this stuff? I mean, you guys had to have said things like that to each other.
Well, the funny thing is we didn't usually. I guess it's not so funny. It's kind of understandable. We were taught not to compare notes. Because, again, you can end up getting contaminated that way. You talk to a viewer that's working on the same project you are, and you start hearing what they're saying, and you're telling them what you're doing, and then it gets all muddled up, and when you go into remote view, it can really mess things up. And so we got to the point where the operational things we were doing, we really didn't discuss with each other. Occasionally, maybe when it was all over, on the few occasions when we did get final feedback, we might discuss it. But in the actual doing of it, when we were actually in the operational phase, we actually didn't compare notes, and we didn't talk about things going on in the world that might possibly be things we would test on either, for the same reason. We didn't want to contaminate each other or ourselves.
Give me an example, Paul. Let's say search for a weapon, some special weapon that the Russians, the Soviets at the time may have had. How did you handle it? What did you do? And how do you pass the information on to them? I mean, what do you tell them, your customer?
Okay. Well, let's say that the customer knows or at least has gotten word of a secret Soviet weapons test against some indigenous folks in Afghanistan. This was an actual operation, in fact.
All right.
Okay. The customer probably has some notion, heard some reports through other channels that something happened, but is not able to develop any more information on it. So they come to our operations folks and say, okay, we have this tasking. Now, it may actually come down from further channels. They inject it in the system further. It doesn't matter. The tasking comes in the operations folks. Those folks figure out how they're going to task the viewers to work it. And, they usually try and get two or three viewers together to work it individually, obviously. And they will come up with a tasking, which is usually a coordinate or something like that, and they'll individually work the viewers. And the viewers will be completely blind. So after the first set of sessions, the analysts will take that information, compare it to what they already know about it, and then determine where the viewers may be on and where the viewers may be off. Then the monitor that's working it may go in and the monitor's told, okay, well, the viewer A said this kind of stuff in his session. That could be interesting, and we'd be careful not to reveal too much, but obviously if the monitor goes back into the room with the viewer and says, okay, you said this in your session, can you tell us more or tell me more about that, the viewer's going to say, oh, I must have said something that was on at that point, So you can't escape that. There's no way to do that. But nonetheless, the viewer then hopefully then expands on what was said there, and then that is again taken back and compared, and it goes through this process sometimes through as many as 15 or 20, and in some one extreme case with a Iran hostage situation, more than 200 sessions all together with the viewers working.
And what did the customer then do with the information, assuming it was accurate?
Well, it's standard you inject in the system. Now, first of all, they would take our raw data. It would get analyzed. They'd pick out the material that seemed to be accurate in terms of what they already knew about the target. And then that information would be put into a report and sent, you know, through the system eventually to the Defense Intelligence Agency, which does the analyzing for that collects all the intelligence in. It's kind of the central clearinghouse. Analyzed, and then ultimately finished reports would be sent out to the decision makers, people who needed to know, you know, what the information was.
Do you believe at this point, Paul, that you guys were successful in finding things, anything?
Yes, as a matter of fact, the CIA ultimately, after a great deal of delay and aggravation, ultimately released 90,000 pages of Stargate archives. And in those archives, I have found a good deal of information. You know, the original raw data, some of the feedback, some of the analysis, all put together, and you can see where, in a number of cases, we were very successful. Now, when they released the archives, they very conveniently stripped off the operational data, the material that actually told you what the targets were. They conveniently removed a good share of the best, the feedback and the best results, the best evaluations we got. In fact, it was really kind of amusing to see this. There'd be this evaluation from one of our customers saying, this project was very successful. The remote viewers produced blank. There's this big black square on there, and there's no way to tell why it was successful. You know, so it was interesting.
Did it get frustrating?
Oh, absolutely. It was frustrating, you know, of course, from this vantage point, looking at that and seeing yet again, just evading capture, the smoking gun that we were looking for to show that we really were successful. We knew we were successful. We did get feedback at the time on a number of projects that we knew we were successful on, and hoped that the raw data would then, the actual documentary evidence would be available. And yet here, right in some of the most crucial areas, it was redacted, it was blanked out, and you know, tantalizing and yet incomplete. So
how often, Paul, would you guys remote view? Every day?
Usually
for 7 years, in your case?
Yes, you usually worked every day, but you wouldn't necessarily work an operation every day. Interestingly, one of the documents I found in the archives was a guide to how much you should work a viewer, and it said, you know, for surge efforts where you really had crucial intelligence development, it was time-sensitive and all that, you could work a viewer up to 2 to 3 times a day. But it was not recommended to work a viewer on a, you know, high-intensity kinds of things, kinds of operations for long periods of time, and the recommended amount was an operational session every other day. But on the days we weren't working in operations, we may do training targets of some sort or some research kind of a target.
Did RV see things in real time, or do you also see things in the future?
Well, I like to say there is no such thing as real time. The present doesn't exist. All you have is the past, the very recent past, and the future. Because, in fact, humans have this consciousness window. They have, I don't know, it's roughly a tenth of a second, that it takes our senses to recognize things that have happened and pass that information in to be processed in the perceptual process. And consequently, for example, you asked that question to me, that seemed immediate. It was really, there was this slight time delay, kind of like radio has, you know, to avoid me saying some four-letter word you don't want to hear, right?
Right.
So
not that you would.
Not that I would, absolutely. But what it amounts to is that humans don't perceive time in the immediate present tense the way we presume we do. We have the illusion of that, but it really isn't the case. So we either live in the past, we actually live slightly in the past in a very interesting way. So that totally had nothing to do with anything, really, in answer to your question. I'll tell you right now, most remote viewings we did had to do with the very recent past or the true past. A few were done towards the future, and even fewer of those were successful. I had one particular experience, which I've related before, and maybe at some point, if you want me to do it again, I will, where I actually described a very, in very excruciating detail, an event that didn't happen for another 50 hours.
Go ahead. Tell us.
Okay. Well, that, what happened was I was asked to go over to the operations building where we did all our viewing and do an operation. Now, I had no idea what sort of an operation it was. It turned out it's what we call a directed search, which is essentially go out and look around and see what the heck's going on and let us know. It's sort of a walk through the neighborhood to see if there's something we need to be aware of, right? The words in the tasking were something to this effect: describe the most important event for us to know about in the next few days. Now, of course, the viewer doesn't get that tasking. The viewer gets an arbitrary number that has been assigned to stand for that tasking. And I got the number, and I started describing this structure. I perceived a metallic structure, and it was in the middle of the water, and it was at night. And then I all of a sudden realized it was moving, and I was getting input of radars and weaponry and anti-submarine warfare. And I came to an analytic conclusion that this is a warship, and I had sort of an impression it was a U.S. warship. And I described that a bit, and then I had this further impression of an aircraft off in the distance orbiting around, which ultimately dropped a one or two cylindrical, long, thin cylindrical objects with little stubby wings that made guttering sounds and flew around in a kind of random pattern. Then it developed that, these are all my perceptions now, the flying tubes come together with the vessel, and there is smoke and consternation, and the superstructure of the vessel cants over, and I had an impression of fire hoses on the deck, and all this is going on, and my monitor said, okay, well, where is this aircraft being directed from? And somewhere far inland, I perceived that this was in an enclosed body of water bounded by sandy areas, and this third world country, flat roof buildings, even some domestic animals in the street, it seemed like, was where the control was coming from. And, you know, there was more involved here, and eventually the monitor says, well, you're off. He had expected me to develop some other kind of information.
Right.
He said, you're off. Nobody can be on all the time. This, by the way, was Ed Dames. I guess I might as well say that. He said, you're off. No one can be right all the time. Let's go home. It was the weekend, you know. So I threw the session in the safe, and we went home. Well, Monday morning, Skip Atwater calls me and says, Paul, where's that session that you did on Friday? I said, what's in my safe? Why do you care? Yeah, well, I didn't say quite that rudely. I didn't mean to be rude. I said, it's in my safe, but so what? I was off. And he says, you haven't read the papers this morning, have you? I said, what? And I opened up the paper, and a U.S. frigate had been hit by, it turned out, two Exocet missiles fired by an Iraqi jet.
Oh, my. I remember that story.
Yeah, yep. The USS Stark. And sometime later, I got the after-action report, the official Navy after-action report in a class I was taking on indications in warfare intelligence, or I'm sorry, indications in warning intelligence. And in the after-action report, I was able to trace my session in terms of the details I provided with that after-action report, and it was amazingly accurate. And I don't say that to brag, because I will admit right now I've never had a session that good before or since. That was one of the cleanest remote viewing sessions I've ever seen.
Why do you think? Were you in a different state of mind? Or was it something you ate? What happened?
It may have been something I ate, all right. No, I don't know. And to this day, of course, there's so many unknowns about remote viewing that it's hard to say why it happened. It would be very good to know, because we could duplicate those circumstances and hopefully, you know, have a similar success some other time. But
sure.
But we don't know. There's so much we don't know about this. And the shame is that there is not enough research going on to find those things out anytime soon. But that's a whole different thread to talk about. This particular event was just astonishing, and it's fairly rare because, as I mentioned before, remote viewing isn't particularly reliable in terms of foretelling the future. And I like to joke, when somebody finds out you're psychic, they want you to do one of two things, or maybe both of them. One is to find something that's lost, usually valuable, or someone who's missing, or they want you to predict the future. And both of those are the hardest things for remote viewing to do.
They sure are. Stay with us. Paul Smith, our guest. When we come back, let's talk a little bit about human consciousness and how remote viewing is accomplished. We'll be back.